You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
You're really going to enjoy today's podcast. It's with Amos Winter, who is the Germishausen Professor of Mechanical Engineering and Director of the K. Lisa Yang Global Engineering and Research Center at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Amos's work focuses on creating high-performance, low-cost technologies for resource-constrained communities around the world. His portfolio includes innovations for irrigation, desalination, clean energy, and global health, many of which have been commercialized through startup companies or licenses. He has a brand new book that he's co-written with Vijay Govindarajan called Global by Design, How to Create Innovations That Scale, Travel, and Transform. Enjoy the pod. I think you're going to enjoy today's conversation. It's with Amos Winter, associate professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. He leads the Global Engineering and Research Lab, which is also called GEAR, which focuses on technical challenges in developing countries. And he has a new book that he's co-written. It's called Global by Design, How to Create Innovations That Scale, Travel, and Transform. Enjoy the pod. Amos Winter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in your new book, you introduce us to King Gillette, and it's a name that many people will know as it's become synonymous with shaving razors. But can you tell us about how his successes, and maybe even more importantly, his failures, illustrate the themes of this book?
Well, he read the market right. He understood the core value of what people wanted in shaving. He understood the arduousness and potential danger of using a straight blade razor. And he was able to disconnect that cutting ability of the razor from the big handle thing you have to hold. And mm-hmm. he also was able to replace the thing that had to previously be sharpened all the time with a consumable blade. So he made it both safer and much more convenient to the user. So he really understood user behavior.
But I guess his failure was when he tried to go global, or thought he knew what he needed to do to go global.
That was well after his time. So Gillette as a company really wanted to break into emerging markets, and we highlight their efforts in India in our book. And they made a classic folly many multinationals do, where they took their best product that sold great in the U.S., tried to sell it in India, and it was way too expensive, and nobody bought it. And so they took a step back and really understood the market differences of how people behave in India versus how people might behave as a consumer, and also how they shave in the U.S. And what was uniform across all countries is people wanted a good, close, clean shave. But what was different in India is that men often had to use just a cup of water instead mm-hmm. of a sink to flush the razor out. They had to maybe shave in front of a small mirror, so they had to be much more focused. They had to often do it in the dark. And they also put more time into it than their U.S. counterparts. So Gillette realized that, well, we can use that time to our advantage. And instead of making razor blades with like five blades, like Gillette's modern offerings in the U.S., they could just do one blade, but pass it by your face five times and use that time to their advantage. And instead of having like a handle made of metal that was really expensive, they could just do it all out of low cost plastic. And so they cut costs, but didn't really cut performance. And they made something that met the performance and price points demanded by the Indian market. And they also really tapped into the arduousness still faced by people in India when they were shaving with the classical, what are called safety razors, which have a replaceable blade, kind of the double-sided razor blade that you can unscrew and put in and out. You have to be very careful with those razors because if you have an ingrown hair and a bump sticking out, you can cut it right off. Mm-hmm. And so Gillette built in these features of these that would push down the bumps so you wouldn't catch them as you rub the blade on your face. And so they could lower the stress of shaving. So not only did they make a great functional product, they made a product that made the user feel better. And as a result, they absolutely took over the shaver market in India.
But there's really only one way you're going to figure this out, right? Don't you have to be there? Don't you have to like see how these people shave?
Absolutely. And another mistake they made early on is they did their initial user testing on Indian students in the US at MIT.
Yeah.
But those Indian students had all the amenities available to them as any other American. And so after they made that mistake, they actually went to India and did a lot of ethnographic research in the field to actually study how people shaved, study the pain points, like the stress of cutting themselves, and also study those opportunities they had to utilize to make something low cost but still high value, like giving the person more time to shave because they were willing to take it.
So overall, one of the reasons I loved reading this book is it's so similar to the way we approach our work at Second City. So, you know, we create our shows from nothing. So there's no sort of there's no writing that happens before. There's no separate playwright. There's like we have 12 weeks. We create something out of nothing, but we do it in front of an audience. So we're constantly testing it. And my friend Linnea Gandhi was sort of chief of staff for Danny Kahneman on his last book. And I remember her saying to me, one of the keys to Kahneman's greatness was that he saw the world as a problem and he loved it. Like that to him was a good thing. And I think that's what I get when you talk about this idea around wicked problems, which is a term I'd heard a bunch. And I had not heard the term wicked opportunities, but it feels to me that that's kind of what you're getting at, which is like, hey, this stuff is complex and it's profound and it's deep and it's tough. And that's part of the joy of it.
Yeah. And I'll give you an example of that. So when I was kind of coming up through the ranks and wanting to apply for a faculty position, I had many people say, oh, you can't work on developing world technology. That's not real science. Those problems are already solved. And there's no real business there because those people are poor. And I was always struck by that because I was like, how can you look at billions, literally billions of people, many of whom are facing life or death challenges that are technical in nature, and our solutions in the US and Europe to those problems have not mapped over for generations, so we need new solutions. How can you look at that as not a great opportunity for science and research? So I totally hear that. It is like those wicked problems do present amazing opportunities, wicked opportunities for innovation.
Yeah, there's an improv adage, see all obstacles as gifts, that we're trying to put that in the mind of the improviser, which is like, don't let it throw you. It's perhaps the portal to someplace really interesting. And one of the examples you use throughout the book is this leveraged freedom chair. And I know from my experience, when I married my wife, Anne, she had a brother, David, who was in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And until you experience what that's like on a day-to-day level, you have no idea what these people go through. I mean, we were stranded on New Year's Eve in places in Chicago waiting for a taxi that would be able to take him wheelchair for just multiple New Year's Eves. Like, it would be hours, 3 hours outside that would happen. And when you worked on this, right, this wheelchair?
Yeah, I designed it. I worked on it as a side project through grad school, and then it was the focus of my postdoc, and then we launched a company out of it.
Okay, so talk about what it was, what you were meeting, and why it shows up in this book.
Yeah, so what motivated this that product was it all started when I spent a summer in Tanzania, working for a wheelchair organization that taught people how to start their own workshops and make their own wheelchairs. And then I was also working with a group in the US, that designed developing world wheelchairs. And I did a big assessment of the current state of the art. And what stood out from that is there wasn't really a product that was well suited for rural areas. Yeah. So a mobility device that was kind of like a mountain bike, but for your arms, powered by your arms, that could enable you to go pretty long distances on rough terrain if you want to go from home to school or work. But what was also a challenge about that device is ideally it would be small enough to use indoors. So you could get inside your house, you can navigate around your kitchen, you could get up to your toilet and slide off and use the bathroom. And so that really stood out as a glaring problem to me. And I felt, well, I'm a trained machine designer. Maybe I can do something about this. So that started a multi-year effort of trying to figure out how could we make this mountain bike for your arms? And the challenge was such that there was already off-road wheelchairs on the market in the US, but there were thousands and thousands of dollars. But a wheelchair that would be actually adoptable in developing countries had to be a few hundred dollars. Right. So somehow we had to navigate this huge disparity between price and performance relative to the prior art. And so what I finally came up with was this drive system that uses two levers that the user pushes on. And when they push on the levers, the levers pivot on just bicycle parts. So just very, very common standard bike parts you can get anywhere. And you can slide your hands up and down the levers to change the effective lever length. So if you're going through mud or sand, you grab high on the levers and get a long lever, generate a lot of torque. And if you want to go fast, you grab low on the levers. And when you push, you go through a bigger angle every stroke, and that makes the wheels go faster. So this very simple mechanical platform, one, we could source the parts and repair them anywhere very cost effectively. Two, it didn't have the mechanical complexity of like a 10-speed bicycle that has a derailleur that shifts the chain between different gears. It was a much more simple system. And that was a result of utilizing the person as the most complex part of the machine, because the person was moving their hands up and down. That's the actual difficult motion. Whereas the bike parts just had to spin and spin and spin like they would on a single speed bicycle. So this ended up being a very effective product in that we could go about 80% faster than a regular wheelchair on rough terrain, produce about 50% more torque than a regular wheelchair, and we're also like 40% more efficient propelling it than a regular wheelchair when you're going on off-road terrain. And so that a variant of that product is still made and sold in the US called the Grit Freedom Chair.
Is that an example of reverse innovation, the one that's back here?
That's where I really cut my teeth on this idea of reverse innovation, actually. So the backstory of that was we started focused on the developing world and made the Leverage Freedom Chair, or LFC. We call it by that acronym. And we set up production in India and made a bunch of those. And as we got more exposure of the product, people would reach out to us from the US or Canada and say, like, wait a second, you have this off-road, all-terrain, low-cost, easy-to-repair wheelchair. We want that too. Why don't you sell it in developed markets? And it made us kind of scratch our heads and be like, yeah, that's a really good idea. So that's when we started the launch of the second product line, which is the Grit Freedom Chair. And it was funny. We went through this process of designing that US product, and I didn't know of that term reverse innovation at that time. Mm-hmm. And then I read the book of my co-author, Vijay Govindarajan. And I read that, and I was like, this guy's talking about what we're doing. And I reached out to him. And at that time, I had just started as a faculty member at MIT and invited him to come give a talk. And we got to know each other and became fast friends. And then, you know, years later, produced this book together.
All right. So I was reading your book, and it sort of inspired a thought in my brain, because we've been in the last, like, especially like the last 6 weeks or so, last couple months, we've been getting hired by a lot of companies to work with their humans on building their most human skills in the world of AI. So understanding that AI is taking on certain jobs, duties. So what are the human thing? Problem solving, storytelling, collaboration, communication, messy conversations, all that stuff. And improv is a great way to practice that stuff. And conversely, I've been having conversations with my wife, Anne, who runs our college program, and recognizing that there's this other phenomenon that's going on in colleges, which is a lot of kids are coming into their freshman year, and they are lacking the social skills that they need to navigate the world that they're in. And I'm reading your book, and I'm like, huh, I wonder if we could take this one thing that we're doing for companies, this problem that we're identifying in schools, and create a gap year. So let's say you're a graduating high school student and you're going to take a gap year. Could you be served by the social emotional improv learning that you would do at Second City to prepare you for the mess of human life when you get to college, which then might help you with the mess of human life when you get your first gig in the working world?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I teach these young people at that age, and
yes.
And you know, the pandemic did a number on them.
It did a number. Yep.
Not only lack of social interaction, but also lack of independence growth, because they were locked down with their parents instead of being high school kids, you know, out and about. Yeah, I think it's a really good idea, and I love this idea of using improv as this vehicle to grow those social skills, because I think it's great in that you have to put yourself out there, but it's in a very safe space, right? Because it's all around humor. You're not being evaluated for a promotion on it. Right. So I think it's a very clever idea, actually. And what I also really like about it, and this is great for students of that age, is you have to think on your feet and be creative without, like using computational tools.
Yes,
right. When you're in improv. And this is an interesting thing we're navigating as educators right now, in that there is going to be this continued growth of a symbiosis between how the students are thinking and how they're utilizing digital tools, right? Mm-hmm. They don't need access to information in their brain because they have that ready access through the internet and through AI. And now I think there's going to be more and more synthesis that happens with AI as a partner. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to tease out similar stuff, I think, than what you were talking about with the companies, of like, how do we best utilize the merits of human intelligence with AI?
Right.
And what I'm finding so far that's very, very encouraging from our students is they're using AI more as like a study partner, as somebody to pose problems to, and get AI's thoughts and reflect on that and oftentimes say, well, no, that's wrong, you know, or that doesn't make sense. And so I was really concerned, actually, at the beginning of this semester, our spring semester. This was our first semester, by the way, AI could solve our homework problems in the sophomore level mechanical engineering class I teach. And I was worried that, oh, students are just going to put their homework in, copy the solutions, pass it in. And I expected to see a big uptick in homework grades and a big downtick in exam grades. It's not what we saw at all. We saw no change in grades. And as we dug into it, we realized, oh, students are using AI as a study partner, just like they'd use another person, a peer. And I don't have a problem with that, because oftentimes they were correcting AI. Oftentimes they were probing AI to understand how it did a calculation and would learn by that process, or learn to correct AI and learn it deeper themselves as a result. So I think AI can be a very powerful tool for that younger generation. But going back to your question, I think using improv is a great idea.
Yeah, great. Well, so what's interesting about this is, I was listening to the Hard Fork podcast this weekend, and they talked about, I don't know if you heard about this, someone was writing about this Brown professor, I think it was Brown, where he had let them do a take-home test and everyone scored the 98th percentile. Then they did the same, they did another test and everyone was in person and they were all like 46%. Mm. And you know, it was like, well, AI did this. but I think I think the reality is it's different in different places at different times. We in no way have enough data to know that there is one thing going on, which is also related to your book.
Because absolutely. Your book,
yeah, right. You're very much talking about that you need to look at your very human way you enter a problem, how you enter a decision. You have a great phrase where you say you need to become a tempered dreamer. Mm. And I want you to talk a bit about what that means, because I think I like both. I think what it implies is like, I want you to be a dreamer, but you got to do it with some intentionality.
Can I answer this in two parts, actually? Cause I want to comment on AI too. So we're in this interesting, I think, phase right now of society's excitement about AI. And I think it's very much a buzz and somewhat bubble phase. AI is going to be around forever. It's a wonderful tool. It's not a knock on AI, but it's not yet a tool that can solve every problem. And what I see in my work and what I tried to convey in the book is that we have to synthesize information as people to solve the wicked problems in global markets in a way that goes so far beyond AI's capabilities right now. I think about this. I talk about this all the time, you know, professionally, in that, you know, I have to have a much deeper understanding of the physical world than AI has right now. You know, mm-hmm. there's like imperfections in plywood on the floor of a house, and, you know, the friction things have and what happens when they get wet and like all these nuances. It comes from a physical interaction with the world. The second is AI, or like I have to synthesize information that's not formally categorized or recorded. So when I'm working in the field, I have to talk to people about their preferences and how they allocate their economic resources and cultural practices. And then I have to synthesize that with like math and physics. And those are such disparate data sets. They're not all put into a large language model right now. Like AI doesn't have all the information because a lot of it is not formally recorded. And then a third piece of the work I do is that face-to-face rapport building that you have to connect with people as common people, and you share experiences. And like AI can't sit down in a person's kitchen and have a cup of tea and talk about how their dad was a jerk and their girlfriend mm-hmm. dumped them. And like, you know, all these things like form a bond between people. And as a product designer, that's such an integral part in teasing out real information from people and their real wants and needs. So we've seen an uptick, and I think we're seeing this nationally, an uptick in enrollment in mechanical engineering, because mechanical engineering deals with a lot of these aspects. But then as a subset of mechanical and what I do in designing technologies for low resource settings, I'm always like, boy, AI is a long way away from being able to not only gather, but then synthesize all the data that me and my colleagues have to.
Let's stay on this for a second, because one of the things I don't know if I'm 100% correct on this, but one of the things I understand about our work is we're very comfortable with using failure. We have a phrase, make mistakes work for you, because what we also understand is when we're using improvisation to create comedy, a lot of comedy is about what's wrong, right? Mm. So we're totally comfortable with wrong is good, wrong is valuable. We work well with wrong. AI doesn't work well with wrong. AI is really like they don't understand. AI doesn't seem to understand the value of a failure with regard to being a piece of a thing that you can kind of yes and into the world. And again, I'm not an AI doomer. It's just especially for a creative company, it's finding where are you going to use these things that are going to be net positive. So my wife's program at Columbia College here is a comedy program. It's the first ever comedy major, a BA in comedy. And one of the things that she tells her students, she cautions them not to use AI to make their lists, because she's saying, you know, you have to go observe the world that you're going to go comment on. And one of the things that is really useful is that, you know, it's your observations and your list of how you view the world that's going to connect with audiences. And the minute you put that through someone else's filter, it's no longer your voice. Mm. And so And her experience so far is that they all get that, and that's probably why they took the program anyway. So she hasn't had to fight the AI monster yet. They'll use it for other things in terms of research, and sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. I'm actually very heartened by the way you're talking about it, because I feel like the discussions, everyone seems to be talking past each other. It always seems to be like it's either terrible and no one should ever touch it, or it's the savior of the world and you should not criticize it in any way.
I think it's great. It's been amazing to me how it's transformed how I operate as an engineer, actually, in that I can aggregate data so much faster than I could before. If I want to know like all the specifications on a certain type of material and all the suppliers, the main suppliers in the world of that material, oh my God, it's amazing at that. But that creative synthesis that happens that people are still good at, it's not as good at that. And I think also people are really good at coming up with new ideas with very little prior data about similar ideas. And so I'm waiting for the day where AI can make a leap like what was equivalent in human history of like going from a vacuum tube to a transistor. Like functionally, they do similar things, but how they operate is completely fundamentally different, right? It's like really orthogonal thinking that got there. In a popular culture reference, imagine feeding into LLMs all the Broadway shows up until about 2015. You're not going to get Hamilton out of that as an output. It's too orthogonal, but people for whatever reason can think orthogonally. Right. And I think that's one of our great merits as innovators that I'm not an AI expert, but I think AI is a long way off of that because most AI models are built on like large data sets and kind of finding trends in them.
Yeah. What we've talked about, we've been having this conversation with some folks at University of Chicago at the Data Science Center there about, could AI be effective to go into the Second City archive? So we own every script that has ever been developed here. So there's 68 years of comedy. Could it go in and give us some mapping around what Americans have been laughing at for nearly 70 years? And could that be an interesting place for scholarship? Because, you know, one of the things is like we do work a lot where we replace a focus group by, you know, rather than asking questions, we perform on stage, and let's say it's for Purina dog food. They were a client once. What the folks in the room are gauging is the laugh, because a laugh doesn't lie. Yeah. So, and could AI be helpful in teasing out that? Whereas, you know, no one here, I mean, my wife Ann and I have worked here the longest, and that's 40 and 38 years. We don't have the full scope, and we forget. We don't, you know. So I think I can see value inside something like that. It's never going to write the shows.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it can make something. My guess, again, I'm not an expert in AI, but my guess would be it could produce some pretty funny comedy. Mm-hmm. But is it going to look like the next Will Ferrell? Probably not.
No.
You know, these stand, because I think part of like what makes these standout stars is that they are different from what you've seen before. You think about like Richard Pryor in his era, you know, or Dave Chappelle right now. You don't get extraordinary by averaging, you know?
No. Yeah. Peter McGraw has this line about you want hot tea or cold tea, you don't want tepid tea. And I think sometimes when you revert to a mean or an average, that's an instant like, well, that's boring. Yeah. All right, let's go back.
Tempered dreamer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was a really important point to convey in the book that I thought a lot about for a few reasons. One, as an innovator, I think it is valuable to reflect on your own limitations. Right. That like nobody knows everything. Nobody can do everything. And so it is good to dream and to aspire. but within the bounds of where you can actually affect change, right? And that's what the Tempered Dreamer is about. I think a second reason it's important is we very much live in an era where like new ideas are celebrated just for being new. And we talk about in the book, like we really saw this during the pandemic with people who were trying to make new low-cost ventilators. And no knock to them. Like they were really trying to come in and save the day, right? And we were just, we were celebrating that effort, which was a heroic effort. But if you look at that situation and look at the requirements for a ventilator, the time it would take to for the traditional production to scale up, like maybe hacking together ventilators wasn't going to be the big win in the end. You know, and it's easy. I'm being a bit of a Monday morning quarterback, you know, because I'm saying that in hindsight. But like, I remember feeling it at that point because I was kind of comparing ventilators to PPE masks. PPE yeah. masks, you can crank out. They're simple, right? And a lot of organizations did, and it made a big impact. Ventilators are very strictly regulated, very sensitive medical device. And it was, and we already had production capability there, just needed to catch up to the demand. And I remember thinking, I was like, I don't know what's going to happen here, but my gut is that we're just going to catch up, you know, with the existing processes. I think about this all the time in college hackathons. Hackathons are wonderful educational tools because they get a bunch of students together and you start bouncing ideas off each other. And it's a very creative process. It may be very similar to improv actually in that creative endeavor, but as a means to solving real world problems, hackathons lack so much context. So I think if you can go into a hackathon as a tempered dreamer, you can take the value of the hackathon for what it is and say, I'm going to generate a lot of new ideas. They may not be great ideas, right? I still have to compare them to a lot of real world requirements that I'm probably not exposed to in the hackathon, right? And so, yeah, we talk about in the book that like ideas are relatively cheap. Good ideas are much harder to come by, like tractable, implementable ideas. And that's all part of this idea of being a tempered dreamer and that you're grounding yourself in the reality of what is possible and what you are capable of, but still trying to stretch your imagination and stretch your creativity as a dreamer. So it's being a pragmatic dreamer.
So one of the things I love about hosting this podcast is sometimes the connections between the books I'm reading, the guests I'm having on are just so... So I just finished David Epstein's latest book, which is called Inside the Box. He had wrote Range, which was he's a science writer, and Range was praising generalists. This is about how creativity desires constraints. And there's a whole section where he met with all the alumni from General Magic. Do you remember this company? It was the most celebrated company of
I don't
tech
know
bros.
Gentlemen.
Okay. Yeah. So it was all the best tech bros from wherever. And there was a documentary made about them because they were given so much money, this group. They were going to change the world and nothing came out of it. You know, everyone went on to other stuff. And one of the points he makes in the book, and this totally applies to what we've been talking about and also your idea of like, rating the parts bin. Is towards the end of the book, he's like, as he's meeting with these alumni, he's realizing, no, a bunch of the stuff that they did kind of start to work on became things like the Palm Pilot. You know, it was like he's saying both they made a bunch of impractical things because they could do anything they wanted, all these smart people. They had no constraints whatsoever. But they were super smart and they ended up using these sorts of elements. And I think that idea of, you know, and this is a yes and, right? You are working from a place of abundance. We recognize that not every scene, not every joke, not every idea is going to work, but we really don't know that until we put it up on its feet. So first of all, allow it to be put up on its feet. And then you don't need to forget it completely because at some point that might work. You know, you might bring it back or you might not, or you might bring it back 3 shows from now. And you very much seem to operate from that sort of yes and spirit.
Absolutely. I say this to students all the time, that you want to constantly be building your design library in your mind. And I talk to them about going to car museums and train museums and, you know, airplanes and just studying the engineering world around you, because you're building that archive in your mind. I think, like you mentioned a few minutes ago, failure has a lot of value, because you learn what not to do in the future. And all that is great as far as developing an individual and I think growing their capacity for creativity. In terms of being a tempered dreamer, what I'm getting at is, like, I'm going to give you kind of an egregious example. When the big earthquakes happened in Nepal, this was about 10, 15 years ago, there was an effort around me to do a hackathon for solutions for Nepal after the earthquake. And I found that kind of offensive, because there was no way a hackathon nor even an academic enterprise could react with the expediency needed by Nepal at that moment. Hand that over to the Red Cross, right? And agencies. They were good at doing that. And so that's kind of the realism that I think innovators have to have sometimes, is that blue sky thinking is good, but it depends on the context, right? And it depends on the stakes, right? So expanding one's mind in a hackathon and having fun and being creative, that's great. I have no issue with that. But are you going to solve the immediate problems for earthquake ravaged Nepal? Likely not.
Yeah. I mean, you have a phrase in the book where you say technology is not the right solution to every problem.
No, and it's not.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, it's, you know, you're a carpenter and you got the hammer and you're looking for the nail. I think that every domain tends to see the world through their particular domain expertise. And it becomes hard to sort of, like, jack yourself out of that and recognize, like, maybe this is the other thing I see when I see social media. It's like, maybe sit this one out.
Well, and you know, you just gave a great pitch for our book. Like, we are very much trying to break innovators out of that mindset. You're exactly right, Kelly. That and I observe this constantly, where people look at problems through the lens of their subject matter expertise, and it takes diligence and effort to be able to step yourself back and look at problems agnostically and say, like, why is this a problem? What are the metrics of performance that would have to be satisfied to solve that problem? Is that in my wheelhouse or not? And then we build this up in the Venn diagram of problem merit, innovation merit, and value merit. So we build on this further to ask ourselves, oh, does this problem actually need innovation to solve, or can it be solved by just adapting prior art or just, like, donating money? And then trying to map out the value propositions too, because the common story of the brilliant engineer who has the most wonderful solutions to a problem, but they can't sell it to anybody, you know? Right. And this is unfortunately a classic folly in academia, that people come up with these wonderful, brilliant, novel things that are worthless in the real world because they don't satisfy those metrics of performance around value and why people would disseminate and adopt it. Right. So we try to map all that and give guidance to be able to see that whole landscape and figure out, going back to tempered dreamer, like, figure out, oh, what problems and opportunities fall in my niche of capabilities? And am I positioned to actually tackle those problems and innovate towards those problems? And am I confident my solution will deliver enough value that people would want to actually adopt them?
It's interesting too, because you're in that tempered dreamer section, you also talk about we have great examples of people who missed the boat on these things, and everything from Google Glass to New Coke. Yep. You know, these ideas of, like, no one asked for this, no one wanted this, And it feels like these are such expensive bets. The metaverse, like how much money got spent on the metaverse?
Yeah.
Billions.
Yeah.
And then now it's just no. And then what Zuckerberg has to do is go back to what he's really good at, which is finding something that already exists and tacking that on to his empire.
Yeah, a way I put this is that a lot of innovation happens by playing darts blindfolded. Mm-hmm. When you throw enough darts, you hit a few bullseyes. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is help innovators aim.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I love that. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. I am actually very eager to hear what yours might be.
Well, Kelly, I live in a yes and space mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I am constantly faced with problems that look like yes ors of, oh, you can have high performance or low cost. And so somehow, we're working in emerging markets and we have to somehow deliver high performance and low cost. And so I think one good story, and I talk about this some in the book, is our work on prosthetic foot design. Mm-hmm. So prosthetic feet that you get in Europe and the US, they're typically made of carbon fiber. And that's chosen because it can flex and store energy and help propel you as you take a step. Problem is those products cost around $1,000. And so we've worked a lot in India with the world leader of prosthetic foot distribution. Jaipur Foot is the name of the organization. And they wanted an improved product. And as we studied the market, we realized, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could provide that performance of a carbon fiber foot at a price point of a developing world foot? And so we ended up being the first group ever to fully characterize how does the mechanical design of a foot affect how a person walks? And we could optimize the stiffness and geometry of the foot to get a person to walk as desired. And through that process, identify low-cost materials that still flex and store a lot of energy. So from that process, we were able to make a plastic foot architecture that just costs a few dollars. And then we actually worked with Vibram, the world leader of hiking boot sole manufacturing, to make a sole and overmold, and ended up making a product that costs a fraction of a carbon fiber foot, but provides as good or better performance.
You know, what's funny as you're talking about that, I'm also linking it to when you talk about how the Wright brothers did what they did.
Mm.
Right? I mean,
yeah. Like, would that be, what are you thinking? How are you connecting it to the yes?
Well, you're talking about this idea of like, well, they need to understand so much of the stuff, how the dynamics work, the aerodynamics work, and then finding out ways to sort of test this in ways that wouldn't be, you don't want to hurt an individual and test it. So I think sort of like it's the seeds of like what can become, world changing with regard to like what the Wright brothers did. And I don't know, it just sounded similar to me.
Yeah. I think a big part of being an innovator is one, not falling into traps of assumptions,
yeah.
And not imposing false constraints too.
Mm.
Like we could have in that prosthetic footwork, we could have said, oh, you can only make a high performance foot out of carbon fiber. Or we could have, we could have believed the haters who said, oh, you can't make a plastic foot mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. can survive the high fatigue of a prosthetic mm-hmm. foot. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of my professional life, challenging those assumptions or challenging the failures of past efforts, because it's always important to dig in and understand why, right? Yeah. So if physics says why something doesn't work, well, you can't argue with physics. Like that's just laws mm-hmm. of nature. Mm-hmm. But I'm often in situations where I can see like, well, if you tweak this or do that a little differently, there may be a possibility. And so this is a big part of what my research group does at MIT is we do a lot of our term that we use is techno-economic forecasting. And mm-hmm. so what that involves is we will do a techno-economic analysis to understand the market and people's desires and price points and do a prior art review. But then we'll do a forecast by looking at what are the governing physics and mathematics behind the problem? What could be physically possible? how could prior art be modified? And so that brings into resolution usually a North Star of where we should focus our innovation and the path we should march towards. And so it gives us great clarity of what is possible. And it's a very diligent exercise to avoid those false constraints or assumptions by very, very intentionally gathering reliable data from the market and doing rigorous analysis to see actually what's possible. And so from that exercise, we see opportunities like, hey, we actually can make a low-cost foot and a high-performance foot.
Yeah, well, you're acknowledging that you work inside an ecosystem with ever-changing and shifting contexts.
Yeah, that's part of it too. That is hard to predict sometimes. We can't.
It is.
Like the tariffs, right? They affect me, right? That totally changes business models around the world and even for our work.
Yeah, so interesting. I could talk to you forever. The book is called Global by Design, How to Create Innovations at Scale, Travel, and Transform. Amos Winter, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Kelly.